When a little girl begins playing with an imaginary friend, her family is amused. But little do they know that this figment of fantasy actually has a dark past. And then we travel to England to meet a man named Bob. He's a minister of a small town church, trying to do what he thinks is best for his community. But when he reaches out to a struggling young man, he finds himself on the precipice of facing down true darkness. Today on Dead Rabbit Radio. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Dead Rabbit Radio. I'm your host, Jason Carpenter. I'm having a great day. I hope you guys are having a great day too. Hope you guys are having tons of fun doing whatever you're doing. We got a lot of stuff to cover today, so let's get started right away. First off, running into Dead Rabbit Radio command. Everyone get on your feet and give it up for Leo. Woohoo! Yeah, wee! Yeah, he's all doing handstands, showing off. Yay, you do it, Leo. Leo was one of our Spotify Wrapped promoters. They posted their Spotify Wrapped on their social media, showing how much they listened to Dead Rabbit Radio last year. That is a great way to spread the word about the show. Leo, you're going to be our captain, our pilot this episode because of that. If you guys can't support the show financially through the Patreon or YouTube memberships, the merch store, I totally understand. I do. Just do what Leo did. Spread the word about Dead Rabbit Radio. That helps out so much. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell everyone you know. Dead Rabbit Radio is your favorite paranormal show. If you listen to yesterday's episode, you will be aware that my aunt Shirley just died. Obviously still thinking about that. You're like, yeah, something seems a little off. Something seems a little off. Jason, yeah, you know, it takes time to process this stuff. I'm going to miss her. But the show must go on. Leo, let's go ahead and toss you the keys to the Hare hovercraft. Everyone climb on board as Leo hovers us all the way out to a house in the suburbs. Jason, even your sound effects sound depressed. One day at a time. We're headed all the way out to this house in the suburbs. We don't have an exact location for this story, but the year is 2013, and we hover on outside of this house, and we're looking through the window. It's a happy family inside. They're playing Parcheesi charades. They're doing them both at the same time. It's a chaotic game. We see this family inside, just loving life. We see a mom and a dad. And then there's a tween there. We'll call her Sally. We don't have anyone's real names. And then we see a little three-year-old girl. She's kind of like sitting there dancing during the Parcheesi game. She's like, can you guess what I am? Can you guess what I am? They're like, a dancer? She's like, no. And we'll call her Iris. Iris is dancing. And she's kind of running around the house, and she's like, come over here. Wee, look at us. We're flying down the stairs. Hey, look at us. Wee, we're running around. And the family's kind of like, what is Iris up to? Why is she, like, running around the house? Who's she talking to? And Sally goes, oh, Iris made an imaginary friend. And they look over, and Iris is like, we're having a tea party. Yummy. Eating cookies here. Yum, 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 yum. Gobbling them up. And the mother's like, that's so weird. Sally, you didn't have an imaginary friend, did you? And Sally's like, no, I never had an imaginary friend. I think they're kind of lame. Although if I knew that you got to eat invisible cookies, I might have been down. Iris is like, it's dress up time. I'll be a princess and you'll be an elf. Oh, look at you in that elf costume. So amazing. She's twirling around. And the mom's like, yeah, I never really had an imaginary friend either. It's super interesting. Hey, Iris. Iris, come here, honey. Oh, you wait right here. You wait right here. I'm going to go talk to my family. Iris says, I don't know if three-year-olds are capable of having such conversations. Iris walks into the living room, and you got mom, you got dad, and Sally, they're all sitting there. And the mom's like, so you have an imaginary friend? I actually, do you tell the kid it's imaginary? I don't think so. She's like, what? Oh no, he doesn't exist. She turns around, he's fading from view. You don't believe in me anymore. The mom goes, hey honey, Iris, so did you make a friend? I did. He's so cool. Oh, that's really awesome. Well, where'd you meet him at? He just appeared in the house. I mean, that's how you meet people, right? They just appear out of thin air. Mom's like kind of chuckling and Sally's laughing because, you know, this isn't a thing that they've ever really had. Dad's sitting there, though. He's just quiet. He's watching his little daughter play. Doesn't say anything. About a month after this, a month after she made this imaginary friend, the family's sitting in the living room and Mom is on the phone with Grandma. And Iris is running around the living room playing with her friend. Ooh, let's play hide and go seek. I'm it. She's looking around forever. She's like, I guess this was an imaginary friend. I guess he doesn't exist. I never found him. Peekaboo. Oh, you're so funny. And she's like talking out loud with her imaginary friend. While the mom's on the phone, Dad's sitting there. Sally's in the living room. They're just kind of gathered around. And Mom's talking on the phone to Grandma about Iris's new friend. And the mom says, hey, Iris, Grandma wants to know, what is the name of your friend? What's his name? And Iris turns and says, Kevy. His name is Kevy. Dad just stands up. He just stands up off the couch, and it's so sudden that Sally and Mom turn and look, and he has a look on his face that they've never seen before. A look of terror. He walks right over to Iris and he goes, what? What did you say? What did you say his name was? Iris goes, Kevy! The room is silent as Sally and Mom look at Dad's face, and it looks like he's about to throw up. Looks like he's physically ill, and he runs out of the living room. Dad, are you okay? Sally says as she's getting to her feet to follow him out of the room. Honey, what's going on? Mom says. But Dad ignores them both. He tells Sally to go back to the living room and doesn't answer any of their questions. The next day, the dad goes to talk to Sally. And he goes, I talked to your mom. I wanted to talk to you. Because there's going to be some changes in this house. There's going to be some stuff that we don't normally do. And I want you to know why we're doing it. Sally's like, okay. Is everything okay, Dad? He goes, I want to let you know why I reacted the way I did yesterday. Sit down. We're going to talk. Dad, who we'll call Clark at this point, Clark says, when I was a kid, I was the youngest kid in the family by 10 years. So I didn't have anyone to play with. All of my older siblings, you know, they were doing their own thing. So I was kind of lonely in the house, and then one day, I met somebody. I came to realize that it was an imaginary friend, but at the time, he was just my friend, and his name was Kevy. We were best friends. Played all the time, I wasn't lonely anymore. But over time, Kevy started to get mean. He started to say mean things to me, and I didn't like it, but I didn't have any other friends, and so I just kind of put up with it. But he got meaner and meaner, and then he started telling me horrible things. He started saying things to me that no kid should ever hear. It made me feel uncomfortable. It scared me. But it scared me even more when he started telling me to do horrible things. And he would tell me to do these horrible things. He was my only friend. I didn't know what to do. But finally, I told him, Kevy, stop. I don't want to be friends with you anymore. You go away. I don't want to be friends with you. And then Kevy left. My parents and my family knew that I had an imaginary friend. They knew about Kevy, but they didn't know what he was telling me and what he wanted me to do. So when I stopped playing with my imaginary friend, they figured that I had just grown out of it. But I knew the truth. I knew that he wasn't a good friend or a good person or a good anything. I don't know how he's back. I'm not even going to pretend to try to think that. I don't understand this, but I do know this. We're not going to let him stay. We are not going to let him say the things he said to me, to Iris. We're not going to let him tell her to do horrible things. So at that point, the family saged the house. He goes, we saged the house. We placed something that he called, quote, cleansing tablets, which I have not heard that term before. But he goes, we saged the house. We placed cleansing tablets at all the entrances. And even now, because he posted this not back in 2013. This was posted online recently underneath the name Simon Size. It might have actually been Sally who posted this. Let me double check that real quick. And like I said, these are all fake names, including Kevy. Let me read this. So this was posted by Sally. I guess I left something out on my notes. She said, the next week or so, my family saged the house repeatedly, went to churches and left cleansing tablets in all entrances to the apartment. I did say it was a house earlier. That was my fault. We told my sister Kevy was not allowed to stay anymore. And while she was upset at first, eventually she stopped mentioning him and we never talked about it again. And it continues, it has been a decade since then. And only recently has this memory come back to me after I've reconnected with my dad and we were reminiscing about our time in that apartment. I didn't mention this event to him, though. So it popped up in her head about Kevy, but she didn't want to bring it back up with her father. My family is very superstitious, and so we completely dropped it, save for continuously saging every couple of months. That was what was in my notes. But this is an interesting thing, too. I said all the names are fake, including Kevy's, because Sally continues, Kevy is not even the real name of my dad and sister's imaginary friend. I didn't feel comfortable typing it out. This has been a long buried memory, and honestly, even typing out the story feels wrong. It's interesting, there's a couple different ways we could look at this story, right? It could be the story of a ghost that is haunting a family. It haunted the father, Kevy, the spirit, attached onto him as a child, and now is haunting his own child. It's interesting that it didn't go to Sally, the firstborn, but went to Iris, who was the youngest at the time. Could be the story of a ghost haunting a family. Could be a story of a demon, right? A demonic attachment. It would be weird that it is so limited. Demons have unlimited patience, right? They can have plans that can go on for eons towards a goal. But for it to take a break, that is, you know, generally the demon would go, okay, well then I would definitely go for your firstborn. Or I'm not going to leave. You can tell me to leave, but we're in this for the long haul. Was it a demon? Was it a ghost? Was it always around? Even when the dad said to leave, did it still linger in some fashion? Probably not. Like, he seems to have had that original encounter with it, and it did go on for a period of time, and then it disappeared, and then it came back. But it is interesting, it didn't go for Sally. It may have, and she may have not have had the insight or intuition or really the developed ability to see and interact with it. There could have been multiple times when Sally was a child that Kevy was trying to appear to her, but she was too distracted or wasn't into the whole imaginary friend thing. You know what I mean? Like, it could be that type of thing. It's also interesting, I bring this up at the end because I didn't think about this before, the fact that she says it feels weird even typing this out and she doesn't feel comfortable giving the name. It could exist somewhere in a gray area. It could be a ghost. It could also be a cognitohazard, which is the idea that a thought can possess some sort of negative ability to it. Outside of a sad thought, a Roku's Basilisk type of thing, which is the idea there is an AI out there that has already won the war against humanity and we are living in the simulation created by Roku's Basilisk. And if you know about Roku's Basilisk, you must do everything in this simulation to help the AI evolve. If you don't, it punishes you. So by simply knowing it exists can doom you to 1,000 hells spread across 1,000 simulations. If you don't know it exists, you don't know. I'll put that in the show notes. That's kind of a... as your brain's melting out of your ears. You're supposedly not even supposed to know about Roku's Basilisk. The second you know about it, you must spend all your time promoting the evolution and eventual elevation of AI above humanity. It's basically testing us in the simulation to see how we will react to worshiping the Basilisk. I'll put that in the show notes. That's a cognitohazard. It's kind of a nerdy version of it. By simply knowing about it, the Bye-Bye Man is a more down-to-earth, more consumer-friendly cognitohazard. Once you know about the Bye-Bye Man, then he can come in and take your eyeballs out or something like that. As you're sitting there, your brain's melting, now your eyeballs are gone. It's possible Kevy is something like that as well. And while it's hard to put into terms, Sally realizes that even just talking about this could cause it to come back into her life or possibly our lives. And that's why she's not using the entity or the spirit's real name. It's super fascinating because, again, what could it be? We've covered a story, something similar to this. This is another story like yesterday's gold story that I've sat on for months because I remember I had another story like this and I wanted to spread them out. Another story about an imaginary friend, a intergenerational imaginary friend, which would make us think that these, some of them are probably imaginary, but some of these imaginary friends are actually entities. They are spirits or demons or some sort of unexplainable phenomenon in some way, because we've seen before, and this one, that it can be passed generationally, even though the father has never mentioned that name. An interesting story. When your kids are doing crazy stuff, always remember, they could be talking to a demon. They could be summoning Roku's Basilisk. You're still scratching your head over that one. You're like, that was a really dumbed down version of it. I'll put the full thing in the show notes if you want to melt your brain. I don't believe in Roku's Basilisk. I don't believe we're in a simulation, so I'm not too scared. But apparently among computer engineers, among tech people, even mentioning Roku. I mentioned Roku's Basilisk 500 episodes ago, and I got more than one email or comment of pissed off people saying you're not even supposed to talk about that. You've doomed me now to 1,000 hells. I don't know if those emails were sent in jest. They did come from basilisk@roku.com email address, but they could have been sent in jest. But yeah, people in the tech industry don't even want to hear that name. For some of them, I'm not saying everybody, but for some of them, it is a cognitohazard. Once you know about Roku's Basilisk, you must serve it in the simulation to prove your loyalty. Because basically, the Basilisk will just keep recreating the simulation over and over again, running multiple versions of it to see how we will react to it. And it's an interesting thing. I don't think it'll doom me to hell, but I've been proven wrong before. Leo, let's go ahead and toss you the keys to the world famous carpenter copter we're leaving behind this apartment. Make sure there's no invisible imaginary friends on board. Just kick wildly in the air in each direction. Looks like you're doing a little hoedown, a little country dance. You're going to kick any imaginary Kevies off of the helicopter. Take us out of this neighborhood and fly us all the way out to England. It's the late 1970s, and we're in the town of Solihull, England. We're going to meet a man. We don't have his real name. We'll go ahead and call him Bob. Robert, if you want to be formal. And he's a minister of a small church in Solihull. And through the course of his work in the community, he meets a man named Jeffrey Jones. Jeffrey Jones, he's in his mid-40s. He works for a company called Lucas Cooksnow Cylon Limited. He works there in their insurance division. And all of his co-workers would describe Jeffrey as a bit of an odd duck. And Jeffrey, whether or not he heard these comments about him, they were definitely true in a way. He just was very antisocial. He would never hang out with anyone. People would invite him to hang out. People would say, hey, Jeffrey, you want to have lunch with us, mate? We're going to down to the pub for a little bit of the fish and chips. And he's like, nah, I'm good. I got my lunch. And he did. He always brought lunch to work. He never went out. And it was always the same thing. It was a dry French bread baguette, I'm assuming, like those big, long, stereotypical ones. You're like, Jason, that's a lot of... He eats one of those a day. He's all... He had dry French bread, Marmite, which I had to look up. Apparently, that's a salty spread that tastes like yeast and veggies. So basically, this guy must have been like COVID patient zero. Must have had zero taste buds. He's like, yummy, yummy, yummy. Salt and yeast, I'm in. Dry French bread, Marmite, and a flask of tea. That's all he ever had every single day for lunch. His coworkers are like, that's a bit queer, even for us. So weird. I mean, we're eating pig intestines stuffed with duck or whatever gross stuff they're eating over there. Because it's always boiled meat. They're like, Marmite, what is this? Black. I prefer my yeast raw. They're just eating spoonfuls of yeast. Anyways, Bob meets Jeffrey Jones. They just kind of come across each other. And Bob kind of goes, you know what? I'm going to reach out to this guy. Like, this dude seems like he needs a friend. And I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. As a minister, I'm going to kind of, you know, be a member of my community. And I just feel like I need to reach out to Jeffrey Jones. And he does. He meets Jeffrey Jones. Jeffrey has a long-term girlfriend. They've been dating a bit. So he's not like completely a loner, but there's just something off about him. And Bob introduces himself and they start talking and he gets to know Jeffrey and he finds out some interesting details about him very quickly. Jeffrey owns a gun, which in America, it's weird that I don't have a gun. I don't have a gun. I grew up in California. They're more trouble than they're worth down there. I've been in Oregon now for 11 years. I still don't own a gun. But in England, that's a bit weird, right? That's a bit weird that he owns a gun. He also, but you're like, Jason, maybe he's a hunter or stuff like that. Well, yeah, maybe. He has a gun. He also keeps talking about yobos. Oh, Bob, it's nice to see you. I'm so glad you're coming around. But you know what? All those yobos out there, oh, man, they're really making England a terrible place. Every single day, just more and more yobos show up. The definition of yobo is a ruffian. But Bob realizes that he's just talking about soccer hooligans. Jeffrey hates Jewish people and immigrants. And he complains about them all the time. And Bob's like, okay, I might have bit off a little more than I thought I could handle. It's like a dry piece of bread covered in Marmite in my mouth right now. But I'm going to help. I'm going to help Jeffrey forgive. I'm going to help Jeffrey accept that other people are people too. And that's when Jeffrey's like, hey, you know what? I was reading a good book the other day. You might have heard of it. Mein Kampf. Have you ever heard of it? Bob's like, yeah, I've heard of it. Adolf Hitler. Yeah. He has some really cool ideas, doesn't he? And Bob's like, oh, man. He's like looking at his watch. He's like, I'm going to have to put in some overtime on this. Owns a gun, hates immigrants, despises Jews. But what's interesting about Jeffrey Jones is he also had a hobby. He also loved film. A man after my own heart. I love movies, right? He actually was a member. And remember, this is like late 1970s. It's not nowadays where you can pull out your iPhone, make a movie. In late 1970s, it took a lot. He was a member of the Silly Hole Amateur Film Society. So he'd go to me the whole time. He's like, hey, guys, you want to watch Triumph of the Will? They're like, no, Jeffrey, please quit bringing Triumph of the Will to the film meetings. Okay, I'll bring Birth of a Nation next time. They're like, ah. He wanted to make movies, and he would tell Bob about the movies he wanted to make. He's like, Bob, I got this awesome idea for a movie. It takes place at a railway yard, which is very cinematic, right? You're going to have like trains and you have like all like this area with all the storage places, you know, like the big containers and like the warehouse. And there's going to be a woman running for her life as a man is chasing her through the rail yard. Bob goes, yeah, that does sound like super dynamic. That does sound like it's totally would be cool. And then what happens? And Jeffrey goes, that's it. That's the whole movie. I'm just gonna film a woman running for her life in a rail yard. Maybe she gets hit by a train. I haven't really worked out the ending. And I was like, wow, okay. So even his hobby's a little weird. But you know, I like horror movies, so I'm not gonna knock it. Short film. But you know, probably should have some sort of plot. He's like, and then Hitler shows up. At least the trains run on time as the train smashes into her. By 1981, though, remember, this story started in the 1970s. Bob and Jeffrey are spending a lot of time together. By 1981, Jeffrey actually starts to change his view. He doesn't hate Jewish people anymore. He starts reading the Bible. That's probably a big part of that, right? There's a lot of Jews in the Bible. It's kind of hard. Kind of hard to have those two thoughts in your head. People do it, but he's like, wait, so this character here is also Jewish? This Noah guy? Yeah, that guy's Jewish. Wait, this Moses guy? He saved all those Jews from, yeah. A lot of good Jews in the Bible. Oh, okay. So anyways, eventually Jeffrey goes, maybe Jews aren't so bad. He starts reading the Bible. He actually starts making an effort to get to know more of his coworkers. Jeffrey Jones, like Bob's like, wow, I've really gotten through to this guy. He's becoming more social. Can't get him to stop eating that disgusting yeast-flavored sauce. But, you know, little victories, baby steps. Jeffrey ends up leaving his work around 1981. And I, you know, again, the sources on these stories, there were some holes. I don't know if Bob worked at the same company as he did. Because they lose touch for a couple months. Once Jeffrey leaves his job, they lose touch for a couple months, but they reconnect. They reconnect. And after that point, every 3 weeks they hung out. They hung out specifically to just check in and to discuss the Bible. But it becomes more than that. It becomes more than that because while Jeffrey has been dating kind of on and off during this time period, he ends up telling Bob, hey, you know, I gotta talk to you about something personal. I met this girl through a marriage agency, which I guess is the old-time version of, like, Tinder, but you didn't talk so much about sex. It was like you pretended you want to get married. He goes, I met this woman through this marriage agency, and we've tried to have sex, but I can't get it up. Cannot maintain an erection with this girl. Bob's like, well, this is way before Viagra was invented. Bob's like, well, that is unfortunate. What else are you going to say, right? You're like, I'm sorry, man. Yeah, I can't get it up for my girlfriend. Like, nowadays, I'd just be like, dude, go get a prescription. Buy some Blue Chew or something like that. Go to a gas station and get some ground up rhino horn pills. 1983, they're still talking, they're still having these common meetings, and Jeffrey confesses something else to Bob. He goes, hey, remember I told you a couple years ago I couldn't get it up for that girl that I met at the marriage agency? And Bob's like, yeah, I do remember you telling me that. Actually, probably the best answer would be like, no, I don't remember you saying that because it happens to everybody, so I instantly forgot about it. But Jeffrey goes, you know, I met this new girl. I'm dating this girl. It's actually my girlfriend. And I can't get it up. Or I can get it up, but then I can't. What's the polite 1983 way to say this? I can't. Ejaculate inside of my girlfriend. How else are you going to say it, right? He goes, even if I do get it up, it goes soft. Like, I either can't get it up or I can't maintain an erection. That was the term I was looking for. Bob, I'm going to tell you something that I've never told you about myself. Bob goes, okay, Jeffrey, what is it? Jeffrey goes, naked women don't turn me on. Like, women turn me on. But when they're naked, that's when my erection does the old doo, blomp. In fact, I can only get aroused and maintain an erection around women who are wearing a black satin dress. That'd be kind of an odd thing for anyone to say, especially a friend at this point you've known for 4 or 5 years. You've been talking about a ton of stuff, life and religion and Mein Kampf. He goes, I can only maintain an erection with a woman in a black satin dress. So even though I have a girlfriend, I will hire models to wear a black satin dress. Specifically, it's like one of those pencil dresses, a black satin dress, pencil dress. And I'll take photos of them. You want to see? Bob's like, kind of put on the spot, right? You don't want to see them. You don't want to see him. Maybe you're a little morbidly curious. You don't want to see another man's pornography is what I'm kind of getting at. Whether it's the Sears catalog or the most explicit garbage out there. You know what they're doing when you're looking at it. You don't want to be like, yeah, you want to look at these photographs I use? Nah, I'm good. He brings out these photographs and Bob said there was about a dozen of them. Women in a black satin dress. The other clothes was always, you know, whatever. It didn't matter, but they always had to have a black satin dress on. And he goes, one of the photos was a woman in a black satin dress in a canal. And another one of the photos was a woman in a black satin dress at a railway yard. Bob said, after Jeffrey told me this about the black satin dress, because remember, first he just said I'm having sexual problems, and then it was years later before he said, hey, I can only get it up if a girl's wearing a black satin dress. He goes, and once he told me that, he goes, he mentioned it every single time we talked. We met every couple of weeks, and every single time he brought it up. One day, Bob goes to talk to Jeffrey. Hey, how's it going? They're doing their regular thing. Jeffrey brings up the black satin dress. He's like, oh, yes, Bathsheba, the great woman of the Old Testament. I wonder if she had black satin dresses. Bob's like, no. No, there's no black satin dresses in the Bible. What about the Whore of Babylon? What's she wearing? Bob's like, please, let's just focus on the Bible. Jeffrey would bring it up all the time. One time, Jeffrey goes, you know that black satin dress I always talk about? I have something to confess about. I mean, at this point, dude, you're like, oh, what? more is this guy going to say? Bob just has to be like, oh, come on. Jeffrey goes, you know, I can only get an erection when a woman's wearing a black satin dress. I can only ejaculate when a woman's wearing a black satin dress. Sometimes, Jeffrey said, he would wear a black satin dress. He goes, sometimes I put it on myself. And Bob at this point says, listen, Jeffrey, if you really want your relationships to work with your girlfriend or any girl you happen to date, you need to change your mindset. Like, this was where Bob's like, okay, first off, dude, what's interesting is Bob realizes two things at this point. He goes, Jeffrey, you have to change your mindset. You got to get rid of all that porn, all of that personalized photography you made of those women. He goes, burn them and burn that dress. He goes, get rid of it. He goes, none of this stuff is helping you have a physical relationship with your girlfriend. Because that's your big problem that you're talking about. You talk about the pencil dresses. You talk about the photos. You talk about the other girls. He goes, change your mindset. Get rid of all of it. And start working towards pleasing your real life girlfriend. But Bob also realized something else. He goes, Jeffrey is getting off to telling me about this. Bob realized he is now part of Jeffrey's fetish. He goes, he actually gets enjoyment, possibly sexual enjoyment, from telling me about the black satin dress, about the photos, about the girls, about him wearing it. I've become part of his fetish. So he goes, we're not talking about this anymore. Burn it. That's what I would suggest. Burn it. If you keep it, whatever. But we're not talking about it anymore. Because he realized he was now part of the fetish as well. But also, Bob's not a quitter, right? At this point, Bob and Jeffrey are meeting twice a week. It's winter of 1983. Bob and Jeffrey are hanging out during one of their twice a week meetings. I mean, like, that's a lot. It's basically a part-time job at that point. And Jeffrey goes, hey, Bob, I'm going to tell you something I've never told you before. Snow's falling outside of the house. Hot pot of tea boiling on the stove. Bob getting ready to throw on his jacket and run out of the house. Jeffrey goes, Bob, I'm going to tell you something I've never told you before. I've never really told anyone before. Years ago, I met a woman. She was an ex-police officer, and we met, we chatted, and she invited me over to her house. And when I showed up, I had with me a black satin dress. And I asked her to put it on, and she did. Said I wanted to take some pictures of her in the dress. She said, okay. But there was a certain pose that I wanted, and, you know, she seemed to be interested in it. I wanted the photo of her in a black satin dress with a noose around her neck. She said, yes. So I put the noose around her neck, and, you know, you want to make it look real. You don't want to just have the rest of the rope dangling off of her shoulder onto the ground. I carried my end of the rope, and I walked up to the second story, and I placed it over the top of the banister. So she's down there with the noose around her neck, and I'm above her, holding the end, and I began to pull it. And I began to pull it a little more and a little more. She started to protest. She said, Jeffrey, stop. She's starting to struggle. And I pull it. And I keep pulling that noose up. And it tightens around her neck. And she's yelling out, "Stop! Stop!" And I let the rope go. Bob, when I was up there and I was pulling that rope and tightening that noose around her neck, I had an orgasm. Jeffrey said, "Bob, I hate women. I hate them. And when I pulled that noose, I released that hatred. I tied the rope to the top of the banister, went back downstairs. She stood on a stool, and I took those photos. And I just wanted to kick that stool so bad. I just wanted to kick it out from underneath her. Watch her sway and struggle and die." Bob says, "Listen, bro, like, this has to end. This has to end. Burn it all. Like, you almost killed that woman before we were even meeting. You were a different person back then, right? You've come so far, but you still got pictures of that woman. You still got pictures of all those women. You gotta get rid of it. This is not gonna end well, Jeffrey." And the next time Bob and Jeffrey meet, Jeffrey says, "I burned it all. I burned all of it. The dress, the photos. I'm a changed man. Bob, thank you. It's a new beginning for me." The year is 1984. Jeffrey and Bob are hanging out, and Jeffrey goes, "Hey, man, you know, that whole film thing, I'm part of that amateur film society. I really want to start making my movies." And Bob's like, "That's awesome, dude. That'd be a great hobby for you." And Jeffrey goes, "Yeah, dude, and I got like the perfect setup. It's going to be a story about a woman who gets hung." And Bob's like, "Don't do that. Do not, under any circumstances, shoot a movie that involves a woman getting hung. You almost killed a woman when you were taking pictures of her." Yeah, but that was in the past. I'm a changed man. I want to shoot a movie about a woman getting hung. And there's not the whole movie, right? There could also be a part where she's running through a railway being chased for her life. And Bob's like, "Dude." 1985, a sign appears in a local shop in the town of Silly Hole. It says, "Regal Gowns, Film and Fashion. Require young lady for part-time modeling. Experience not necessary. Apply Mr. G. Jones." Then it had his address and his phone number. At this point in time, Bob and Jeffrey are still hanging out. They're still meeting regularly. Whether or not he knew that sign had been posted, we don't know. April 18th, 1985, 3 p.m., a young woman named Marion Terry, 17 years old, shows up at Jeffrey Jones's house. She had seen the ad. She thought, part-time modeling, no experience necessary. Sounds like a plan. She'd contact Jeffrey Jones. He told her a little bit about the photo shoot. Told her what to wear. A black satin pencil skirt. Marion, being a safety-minded young woman, let her father and her friend know where she was going and why. Gave them the address, said, "I'm going to do this modeling thing. Here's the address. Here's when I'm leaving." April 18th, 3 p.m., Marion Terry, 17 years old, shows up at Jeffrey Jones's house. Hours later, Jeffrey's girlfriend gets a phone call from Jeffrey himself. He's freaking out. He calls his girlfriend in a panic. And he tells her, "I think I just killed somebody." 8:50 p.m., an ambulance pulls up outside of Jeffrey Jones's house. When the medical personnel walks in to his home, they see Marion's lifeless body hanging from a hangman's noose attached to a banister. And there was a piano stool behind her, and she slowly swayed there, her feet barely touching the ground. They also see Jeffrey Jones laying there. He had taken 100 aspirin. He OD'd on aspirin to kill himself. But his attempt is unsuccessful. He is taken to the hospital. His life is saved. And the police have a lot of questions about what happened there. He said it was an accident. Kind of. He said, "We were shooting this movie about this woman being hung. The rope was tied up. She was on the piano stool. I went downstairs to get something, and when I came up, she was dangling there. And I panicked. I thought, oh my God, I have to save her. Like, we're just shooting a movie. Something must have gone wrong." And I ran there, and I tried to untangle the noose, and she attacked me. She attacked me, officers. She was scratching at me and biting at me. I was trying to save her life. And maybe it was an accident. Maybe she wanted to kill herself and I was trying to save her. That's why she was attacking me. But I did not kill her. I did not kill her. I did not murder her. And the police go, "Okay, well, you had a film camera there, right? You were shooting a movie." Jeffrey goes, "Yeah." And they go, where is the film? Where's the film? You were filming this, right?" There was no film in the camera when the authorities got there. What they were able to find is a lot of evidence. Bob not included. Like, Bob did come out and talk about all of this stuff after the fact, during his trial. Because Jeffrey Jones was actually brought to trial for all of this stuff. But some of the other pieces of evidence they found in his house was a long narrative written by Jeffrey Jones on a pad, confessing to murder in hatred. They found a poem that they put in quotes, so maybe it's a bad poem. A poem written by Jeffrey Jones called 10 Little Beauty Queens. The last line referring to death by hanging. And then another piece of evidence, a film script entitled Enough Rope. 1986, he was sentenced to life in prison for the murder of Marion Terry. This is an interesting story on several different levels. One is that when we look at cases like this, this is a question, because this is a very, as far as I can tell, an extremely obscure case, even among true crime. We don't know what happened to Jeffrey Jones after he got into prison. Britain is constantly, England, they're constantly letting people go early. Life in prison could be 7 years, it could be 100 years. Nobody knows where he's at now. They said, listen, he was in his mid-40s. When the attack happened, I think he was at 49, actually, by the time that she was murdered. So in 1980, let's say you were 50 years old. At this point, you'd be 90 years old anyways. They go, but we don't know if he was ever released. We don't know what prison he died in or anything like that. No one can find any more information on him regarding that. Britain has some pretty stringent privacy laws, though, as well. So that could be part of that. The narrative that is most known is from Bob's point of view. He has told people about this. He has told people about this crime from his point of view and everything that he was going through. You have true crime believers who think that this may not have been his first murder. And that's why the photo of the girl in the pencil skirt in the canal and the girl in the pencil skirt in the railway may have actually been clues to other unsolved crimes. That Mary and Terry may not have been his first victim, but his last. There's been some rumblings in the true crime community about that, but again, a very, very obscure case. You'll find whispers about it online. But that's possible. Another interesting thing to look at in this case, and we'll wrap it up like this. Well, first off, I want to say, what I find so fascinating about this case, and the reason why I wanted to share it with you guys, is that you and me, the chances of us being part of a true crime case where we are the victim or the assailant is incredibly rare. But I think all of us can relate to being Bob. I think all of us can relate to watching somebody and reaching out to somebody and trying to help them and just seeing it entirely fall to pieces. I think that's a very relatable place to be in a story like this. It's heartbreaking, right? Bob did his best. Maybe it's funny because I was going to say maybe too much just because that seems like a lot of time, but he was trying so hard to help this guy out and it seemed like two steps forward, one step back into the murder closet. Like this guy was eventually going to kill somebody. And I think Bob realized that as time went on. Like, at first he didn't know that this guy might be a killer. But then he keeps getting all these confessions and he's trying to help him out. And then imagine how Bob felt when he found out that this guy he'd worked with for years, like sitting down face to face, talking about all of these struggles, finally succumbed to all of his worst demons and killed somebody. And Bob knew immediately it wasn't an accident, right? He'd already heard that story before with the ex-policewoman. But what's very interesting about stories and stories like this is that you wonder how many of these killers do it solo. Or is there a network? I think when you look at stuff, we know with pedophilia, it always exists in a network. I guess I shouldn't say always, but child pornography always exists in a network. They're constantly trading stuff. So we know that those are actually a group of criminals that are doing that. Killers seem to be more isolated, but is that just an illusion? Because an interesting footnote to this case is the police went to look in the film camera. There was no film. The film was there at one point. He did film the murder. But nobody knows where that film is at. He's never told anyone where it is. He admits that it was on film, and you would think that if it bolstered his story, he would definitely be like, oh, it's in the cupboard. The film reel that shows Mary and Terry's death is gone. It has never been found. The police believe that it exists. The police believe it exists, but nobody knows where it's at, which would make you think that this was some sort of odd network. That this was some sort of, if not highly organized network, that Jeffrey Jones wanted that film to get out there. So he put it somewhere that he knew someone of a like mind would find it. The film of her death is lost media. It really would be the term we would use. And he never told anyone where it was at, or never told the authorities where it was at. But people believe that it's out there somewhere. It's a creepy story. It's really a story of a person, like I said, succumbing to their demons, having those dark thoughts. And we see that escalation, right? It did start up. It's an interesting story too. This sounds gross. I'd love to know where the fetish developed from, why he had that particular fetish. But it first starts off with a sexually frustrated guy, and somewhere in that too came to just a blind hatred towards women, but could still interact with them, could still, you know, talk to an ex-police officer and say, hey, can I come over to your house? Hey, can you put on this dress? Hey, can I put this noose around your neck? Like, he wasn't someone who totally put people off. I guess he was charming in his own way. There's no way you could talk me into putting a noose around my neck. I had to shoot a short film, and they wanted me to stand on the train tracks. And I was like, I don't know, guys. I'll stand next to him. I'll stand as close as I can, but I'm not standing on him. And put a noose around my neck. He's not... The photo of him, he's not particularly a handsome guy. He's not particularly ugly either. He's just kind of normal, but he must have had some way about him to be able to convince a woman to put... Two women to put ropes around their necks. To go to a canal and take a photo in a dress. He had to get him out there. It's a bizarre story. Because he seemed to have, in a way, a way with women. Like, he could smooth talk his way into their house. But at the same time, he hated their guts. He hated them so much he wanted to kill them. He hated them so much he killed at least one. But nobody knows if that was the only one. And we'll never know. The fact that he called his girlfriend after Marion's death makes me think that it might be the only one. Like, he finally had this fantasy going on in his head, and then once it became real, once he had what is termed post-nut clarity, he realized, oh, that was terrible. I shouldn't have done that. And then he concocted this scheme that he's going to make it look like an accident, and it didn't fly because he had so much evidence proving otherwise. Circumstantial, sure, but I mean, it was enough. Could have been his first, and he realized that he made a huge mistake and tried covering it up, and that's why he OD'd on the aspirin. May not have been. We don't know. Who were the other women in those photos? Were they just willing participants letting him take a photo for some side money? Or were they women who were never seen again? Or who were listed as died of a suicide? A young woman hanging in her apartment, unfortunately, isn't rare. So that's the story of Jeffrey Jones, and that's the story of Bob. A man who was just living life. He saw someone in need of some counseling. Actually, no, he saw someone who needed a friend. And Bob decided to be that friend. But Bob never realized that his friend was slowly descending into a world of madness and murder. And Bob was just along for the ride. DeadRabbitRadio@gmail.com is going to be our email address. You can also hit us up at facebook.com/DeadRabbitRadio. TikTok is @DeadRabbitRadio. Dead Rabbit Radio is the daily paranormal, conspiracy, and true crime podcast. You don't have to listen to it every day, but I'm glad you listened to it today. Have a great day.